Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The study of emotion goes back to ancient times, yet there's still plenty that's unknown. In his new book, the eminent psychologist Jerome Kagan takes a fresh, sweeping look at the science of emotions, its history, where we are today and our understanding, and where the latest research is going. Along the way, he offers profound insights into what really goes on inside your mind. This hour, On Point, Jerome Kagan and how we understand our emotions. Joining us now in the studio is Jerome Kagan, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Harvard University. He served as director at the Mind-Brain-Behavior Interfaculty Initiative at Harvard. His new book is What is Emotion? Jerome Kagan, I should say the first emotion I have this hour is that I'm very happy to see you in the studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, first of all, to just start off right where the book launches. What is emotion?
That's the right place to start. The word emotion, like most words that humans care about, sin and good, changes its meaning with time. And so this is the best way to understand what's happened. It doesn't have any official definition. It refers to a cascade, a sequence of phases that begin with some event. Someone pushed you, you saw a child bleeding, you had a thought, or you had a spontaneous change in your brain or body. That starts the cascade. First event, your brain changes. Now, most of the time, that brain change has no consequence. But some of the time, the brain produces a detected feeling. You feel tension in the muscles of your legs. Your heart skips a beat. You feel you're secreting too much saliva. That's a conscious detection. Phase two. Most of the time, you ignore it. Right now, I'm feeling a tension in the muscles of my thighs, but I'm going to ignore it. I'm not going to appraise it. Some of the time, I will appraise my feeling and name it. And then finally, some of the time, after I name it, I might display a change in facial expression, speed up my talk, or do something. That's the territory. Now, what changed with history was which one of those sequences you called an emotion. The ancient Greeks and Romans, they were concerned with that third phase, appraisal, because they thought human mind is very strong. It can control your feelings. Remember, they want to have a civil society. And so they called the appraisal part the emotion. Now, let's go up 500, 600, 800 years to medieval Christianity in Europe. Christian philosophy is very concerned with strong feelings, especially sexual arousal and anger. So they move it back. They're worried about those feelings, never mind the appraisal. And so for them, it was the feeling that was conscious and hard to suppress that was the emotion. And then comes the watershed moment. I'm almost done. Now comes the watershed moment. Darwin. Darwin says, which something no Greek or Christian philosopher could have believed, that animals have emotions that resemble humans. Remember, animals don't appraise anything. And he said, look at the facial expressions of monkeys. Look, when they're afraid, look, their facial expression resembles the facial expression a person shows. So now, since the facial expressions come from biology, from the brain, we now, for the first time in history, make an emotion a brain process. And when, in the 1970s, scientists made dramatic advances allowing you to measure what's going on in your brain, then we had leading scholars, who I respect, Antonio Damasio and others, say, I'll tell you what an emotion is. It's a change in your brain. You may not feel anything, but if your brain changes when you see a snake, that's an emotion.
So does there or does there not always have to be a physical component to this? Some physical change in your body before the brain triggers an emotion. For example, here's what I mean. I'm filling in for Tom Ashbrook today. I have a little bit of topsy-turviness going on in my stomach, so therefore I have a little anxiety this hour. Does there always have to be that physical part that accompanies that psychological part?
Remember, I said, no, this is not like saying what a microphone is. It's up for grabs what an emotion is. Most of my colleagues and I would say yes, unless there is a feeling that's detected, then you're not in an emotional state. But remember, that is controversial.
Let's go right to the phones, Professor. Stephanie is calling from Wrentham, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephanie. You're on with Professor Kagan.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Professor Kagan. This is a great topic because, in fact, at least for me, because I was just talking with colleagues yesterday about emotions. And I'm wondering to what extent, Professor Kagan, you would say that one has to be aware of one's emotions in order to have them. And we were actually talking about them relating to animals and getting to the question of whether animals could have emotions if they weren't aware of them. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this topic.
A very good question. And a difficult one to answer. But remember what I said earlier, Stephanie, there is no official definition of emotion. So those people who would like to believe that animals have states that are very similar to humans have every right to say that that's an emotion. My own preference, Stephanie, would be that we invent different words for the states of animals and the states of infants, and the states of humans, because adult humans detect and consciously appraise and often name their states. Animals don't do that. So I would prefer that we not say an animal is fearful, even though that animal might have a brain state that is similar to that of a child or an adult. Is that clear?
It is, but I'm a little bit curious because certainly it's the state that it is the case that humans, adult humans, can frequently name their emotions, but often people are not aware of their emotions until they're helped to recognize them for what they are. So I'm wondering what you think about having those emotions before you actually know what they are. I mean, you know, it seems like that's part of the job of psychologists and psychiatrists often to help us be aware of what we're actually feeling about things.
All right. Let me rephrase what you said and suggest the following, that often we feel differently. Remember that was stage two of the cascade. We feel differently than we do most of the time, but we don't know why. Yes, that's a special state. Now, if you prefer to call that an emotional state, that's fine.
Professor, let me ask you a question about your research into infants. What range of emotions do infants experience?
Infants react to tastes of different quality. They will show an expression you and I would show to bitter lemon, and they'll smile to sweet taste. They will show an orienting reaction if you present them something they don't expect. The critical issue is, do you want to call their state pleasure when you put sugar water on their tongue and say that that's really basically similar to the state that you and I have when we see a beautiful sunset and say, my, I'm in a very pleasant state. That's the controversy, how similar those two states are. My own view, which might not be shared by the majority, is that because infants aren't appraising their states, that their psychological state is really quite different.
So does that mean that the smile or the giggle of an infant should the infant taste the sugar water, or should someone do something? Should an adult do something in front of an infant that makes the infant smile or giggle? Does that mean we should not necessarily interpret that emotion as the infant being happy?
I don't think we should call.
So we don't know whether we have happy babies or not. Maybe
we don't know. Sleeping babies, 2 days old, will smile. Now, would you say that they're happy?
Maybe they're having good dreams. You suggest in your research that we can predict some of the behavior characteristics of children at two if we watch them closely when they're babies. For example, if four-year-olds cry frequently when they see or smell unfamiliar things, or if they're unusually active, they might be more uncertain. Excuse me, that's 4-month-olds. If they cry frequently or smell things, they might be more uncertain as 2-year-olds.
Right. The book says that your culture and your class, your ethnicity, they determine the appraisals that you will impose on your feelings. But then there are biological differences among us, which we call temperamental. If you were talking about dogs, you talk about breed differences. And these temperamental differences make some infants more vulnerable, more susceptible to certain feelings. And so in our research over the last 30 years, yes, we did show that some infants react to newness, to novelty, by becoming aroused and crying.
Today we're looking at what's behind our emotions. We're speaking with Jerome Kagan, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Harvard, where he served as Director of the Mind-Brain-Behavior Interfaculty Initiative. His new book is called What is Emotion? Professor, let's pick up where we left off right after the break. We were talking about children, infants. Will an anxious baby turn into an anxious adult? Can we identify budding Clint Eastwoods at 4 months old or 6 months old?
Good question. A temperamental tendency, like a baby who is extremely sensitive to novelty or a baby that is not, represents a bias. It's like a tropical depression off Africa, which is not yet a hurricane, but might become one. So these temperamental biases increase the likelihood just a little bit that if you are an infant who is very bothered by newness, you're a little more likely to be an introvert, a little more likely to avoid crowds, a little more likely to want to be a writer or a computer programmer where you're in control rather than a trial lawyer or a surgeon. Yes, but there's nothing determining here, nothing determining, just a bias.
So there's no guarantee then, and you say this in your research, that all babies grow up to exhibit the same emotions as teenagers that they exhibit as infants. Not all timid infants become shy teenagers.
Absolutely not. At the most, maybe 15%. Maybe 15% at the most.
Tony's calling from Boston. Hi, Tony. You're on the line.
Hi. How are you? Thank you very much for taking my call. It sounded like that earlier in the show, what your guest was talking about was the concept of karma, the Buddhist concept of karma. Things that happen to us, you know, come out, you know, we hold that and we view life's experiences in some of the experiences that we've had. And my one question is that when we have discussions like this, why is it always the Judeo-Christian viewpoint of reality? Buddhism has been talking about this for 3,000 years, and that the concepts that he's talking about right now are all in the Buddhist doctrines of the Lotus Sutra and various teachings, and it seems like it's a great revelation now, and that's one question. And the other question is that what is the difference between the mind and the brain? Does the brain influence the mind? does the mind influence the brain? And I want to ask about the concept that whatever an individual believes, they think about, whatever they think about, they ultimately talk about, and whatever they talk about, they become. So is the brain influential on the mind, or is the mind influential on the brain?
Okay, Tony, let's give Professor Kagan a chance to answer your questions.
Tony, those are three difficult and profound questions. Let's start with the last one. I want you to see the difference between brain and mind as the difference between that tropical depression and a hurricane, between the DNA code in your body and the proteins. That is, one emerges from the other. So the phenomenon of mind, thought, karma, perception emerges from the activity of the brain, but we have to use different words. Remember, Tony, the words we use to name your DNA code are not the words we use to name the proteins or the tissues of your body. And therefore, the words for mind have to differ from the words from brain, even though one emerges from the other. And yes, Tony, they do mutually influence each other. And indeed, we now know, based on elegant research, that actually the proteins feed back and can change your DNA code just as the DNA code influences proteins. So there's a reciprocity between mind and brain, between those processes, as there is in biology.
So that they're not the brain and the mind are not stamping out similar computer chips every time there's a new trigger.
That's right. And that, in my own view, that brain processes underdetermine mind. In other words, every time you have a brain state, it's not clear what psychological state would emerge. And the same brain state in two people, Tony, your brain state and mine, if they were identical, it is not obvious that we would end up with the same psychological state.
Let me ask about nationality, Professor. What role does nationality play?
I wouldn't use the word nationality. I would use the word ethnically separated groups. The work of geneticists is now finding that those groups around the world that have not mated for 20, 30,000 years, so that Asians, Africans, Latin Americans, Northern Europeans, who are just beginning to get together because of the ability of the travel, that these groups differ in some of the genes that control temperament. And therefore, what we will see in the next 20 or 25 years are very important discoveries showing that each of these groups is susceptible to different feeling states.
Do me a favor and describe your very interesting research on Chinese and Caucasian infants.
Right. Many people before me noted that newborn Chinese infants are very placid and are not as reactive or irritable as Caucasian infants.
So they don't smile as much or frown as much?
And they don't. If you put a piece of Daniel G. Friedman of University of Chicago did this. He put a piece of Kleenex on the face of Asian infants born in California, so they're Chinese American in their families, and they just lie there, while European Caucasian infants will rip the piece of Kleenex and get very irritable and aroused. And in the book, I document research I did with a Chinese pediatrician showing that at 16 weeks, Chinese infants are much more placid and relaxed when you show them interesting sights or play them interesting sounds compared with Caucasian infants of the very same age.
And why?
Probably something to do with the inherited neurochemistry of the brain. Now, notice it could be the molecules with all those long names like norepinephrine, vasopressin, or it could be the receptors for those molecules. We just don't know.
What are the implications, if we know, what are the implications between biological differences between people of different nationalities or ethnically separated groups?
I think the implications are, for me, very positive that what we will learn in the next 50 or 60 years is that each of these groups has some feelings that are make them more easily adapted to their culture and some less so, but that each group will have advantages and disadvantages and the whole thing will wash out at the end.
So, in theory, at some point, anthropologists might benefit from more and continued research in that we'll know better as adults how to handle our interactions with different cultures?
I think that's true. And as a matter of fact, more anthropologists are becoming interested in this particular problem.
Aaron is calling from Portsmouth, Virginia. Hi, Aaron. You're on the line with Jerome Kagan.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. One question and then one comment with a question. As a physician myself, it's always fascinated me how it is that I'm able to go, for an example, into the operating room and deal with the stresses that go along with that and the worries about what could go wrong, and yet somehow be able to contain that and be biologically, I guess if you will, removed or emotionally removed from it to allow me to do the things that I do where others can't. And I wonder if you could comment on your science and research as far as it relates to understanding that. And then second, there's been many times in the clinic where I've dealt with a patient who, for whatever reason, I've come to find out has had a psychological disorder of some kind. But for me, what it translates into is a sense of uneasiness or, in some cases, agitation in talking with them before I even realize that that is truly the case. And I wonder if you know anything about the biology of why that is. I once had a learned professor once tell me that if the patient's bothering you and you don't know why, they have a psychological diagnosis until proven otherwise, and in many cases that's proven out to be true. And I'll get off the line and let you comment. Thank you very much.
Professor Jerome Kagan.
Two very good questions. Let me try to answer the first. I think that you would agree that some young people who train to be physicians who are bothered initially can eventually adapt to the stresses and the blood and the stimuli that you have to encounter. But on the other hand, it is true that there are some adults who, as infants, were born with a temperament that makes it much more difficult for them to become highly aroused, tense, uncertain when they have to encounter the events that physicians do. And you may have been born with that temperament.
Can focus on the task at hand suppress emotion?
Oh, of course. An attentional focus on a task at hand can blot out the emotion. Indeed, the psychologists and psychiatrists who study this very unhappy situation of adolescents who cut themselves, they take a razor and cut their wrist.
Self-mutilation.
In many cases, when asked why, they say, it distracted me from the terrible guilt and loneliness that I felt. That it instead of focus, it's their way to blot out the psychological states that they could not stand.
Hmm. Aaron, thank you for your call. Let's take another. Peter is with us from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on with Professor Jerome Kagan.
Hi, Bob. I just wanted to differentiate between emotion and behavior. What you were saying you felt in your stomach.
The topsy-turvy nature of filling in today,
right,
for Tom Ashbrook.
Right. That's, to me, is behavior, because in a way you're choosing when you're doing Tom's job, you're naturally nervous because this is
it's not my thing.
Something new.
Right.
But at the same time, your response makes perfect sense, but it doesn't interfere with the way in which you do your job. You're doing fine. And
thanks for that.
Yes, you're great job. But it does not. If you didn't tell us that your stomach was topsy turvy, we wouldn't know it. If you think of a lawyer who's going into court, feels that they will win, they still may blush, they still may sweat, but they are confident and they may win. The last example that I'll use is I stutter, as of course you couldn't tell, but that is proven to be proven to be behavioral and not emotional. In other words, I choose the situations. I'm not nervous right now, but I know that my voice is being broadcast, which I've chosen that as a situation in which I stutter. It wasn't a conscious choice, so I'm not really nervous, and I can speak fairly well. But I guess my point is, the emotion is not overwhelming. So clearly, we choose places. If you're talking to a CEO versus to someone else, if you're talking to a policeman, we create these hot points.
Peter, hang on. Jerome Kagan, let's get you to respond to that. Do we often confuse behavior and emotion?
Yes, we do. And Peter made a good point. I was using the word behavior to mean what is public and can be seen or filmed or coded by a scientist. Peter was saying any response can be regarded as behavior, and of course that's right. Remember, words, Virginia Woolf understood it. Words can change their meaning, but that's what I meant by behavior. Of course, many people do not show their internal feelings, and that's a tremendous advantage that we have over many animals who find it much more difficult. That's why we have a big frontal lobe. So yes, we want to differentiate between the feelings that you have and the behaviors that you display in public that people can see.
What do you think we most often confuse when we do find ourselves confused about behavior versus emotion?
Oh, I think we find it very difficult to know if another person is feeling guilty. I think we find it very hard to know whether another person is feeling love for us, or is lying to us, or deceiving us. Oh, we're very bad at detecting the private emotional states of others.
I also think that maybe the most frequent confusion might be exhibited in that phrase, "Are you mad at me?"
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Let me ask you a question about class. You write about the influence of class and background in emotional response. And I wonder what the link is there. If you can explain that briefly, we're headed for the break, and then we'll pick it up after the break.
Very briefly, every society has a social rank. It's built, of course, on different things. And those in the lower part of the rank often feel an emotion of intimidation when they compare themselves with others. John Updike, in his memoir — John Updike grew up in a working-class home in Pennsylvania — says he often stutters when he's around Boston Brahmins. That's what I mean by the power of class to influence emotion.
Because he's nervous?
Nervous, yes.
We're talking this hour about what's behind our emotions. We're speaking with Professor Kagan, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Harvard University, where he was director of the Mind-Brain-Behavior Interfaculty Initiative. His new book is titled, What is Emotion? And as promised, Professor, let's pick up where we left off before the break. We were speaking about class and emotions and the link between. You had mentioned the author John Updike, and you also wrote about financier and philanthropist Andrew Mellon, who came from another family of hardworking people, Presbyterian farmers from Scotland and Ireland, who felt uneasy about spending money frivolously and may have been emotionally aroused by hard work.
Yes. I think that because America likes to regard itself as a classless society — unfortunately, it is. It is not classless. And in every society, as in monkey groups, those who are in the top ranks are vulnerable to different emotions than those who are in the lower ranks. And this is profound, and it's seen in every society. Humans do not like to feel intimidated. And in our society, at the moment, where wealth, education, and vocation decide your social rank, those who have are less well-educated, work in blue-collar jobs, and have a more compromised income are often feel intimidated when they cannot when they have to interact with those who have more. I'll remember a night. This is 20 years ago. It was New Year's Eve. I shall never forget it. And there were only about eight or nine couples in an apartment. And we went around the room. The hostess decided, "What are you disappointed about?" And each one named. And then we got to the wealthiest man in the room, a man who had made a lot of money in business. Remember, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Everyone's a little drunk. And a tear appears on his cheek, and he says, "I never went to college. That's really been my disappointment. That's what I mean."
You also write that excessive privilege can have its dangers. And you said, for example, something in your book that I found fascinating, that had John Wilkes Booth not come from a family of celebrated actors, he might not have decided he had the right to murder President Lincoln.
I do believe that. I think that growing up in a family of privilege has enormous advantages. It can give you the confidence that we needed in Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. But on the other hand, it can, if you grow up in a family of privilege, you really think that you have a right, that your decisions are always correct. It is my personal belief, obviously, Bob, I can't prove it, that in order to have the guts to decide that you are going to kill President Lincoln a few days after the Civil War ends, you've got to feel you have a right to do that. And I would say coming from a celebrated family helped him feel that, yes, he was entitled to do that.
Let's move the conversation to talk about gender for a few minutes. How does gender factor into the emotions we experience?
In two ways. Obviously, the most important way is cultural learning. Every culture varies in what it regards as appropriately male and female. 100 years ago, it was inappropriate for females to play soccer or be presidents of corporations. It's perfectly appropriate now. It was inappropriate for a woman to disagree with her husband. It's perfectly appropriate now. So the emotions that men and women are entitled to change with time as a function of values. But on the other hand, there are subtle biological differences between the sexes, and they involve more than just the sex hormones, estrogen and androgen. Just name two, as I do in the book. We all secrete two molecules, oxytocin and vasopressin. They're involved when women nurse. They're involved when you have sexual intercourse. Oxytocin is a relaxing molecule. As a matter of fact, there are studies to show if you inhale a little oxytocin, it reduces that topsy-turvy feeling in your stomach. Now, here's the important point. In animals that are high in oxytocin activity, they bond to others. And in monkey species where oxytocin activity is low, they tend to be more hostile and less bonding. Here we go. Oxytocin activity is significantly higher in females than it is in males. I don't think it's an accident that in all cultures, the literature and poetry of all cultures tends to emphasize the tendency of women to bond, to be loyal, to look for harmonious relationships, and the tendency for men to compete and seek more power.
You write, for example, on just this point, that adolescent girls are more understanding of other girls who are socially anxious than adolescent boys who tend not to tolerate well other boys who are shy or timid.
That's right. I'm glad you raised that. In the research you referred to earlier, we started in the work, so we found some very fearful one-year-old boys and girls with the same temperament. Now we follow them until they're 15 years old. the girls began to overcome their outward timidity because girls are kinder and gentler with shy girls. Most boys are cruel to shy boys, and so it makes it more difficult for the boy to recover.
Do these traits in boys and girls tend to disappear over time? And if so, do we know why?
The outward features change. When I was young, there used to be a franchise called Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's easy to change your outside behavior. What's more difficult to change are your internal feelings. For example, in the interviews we conducted at age 15, there would be a 15-year-old in their home. We're interviewing them in their bedroom, so they're perfectly comfortable. And here would be a girl or a boy, relaxed, smiling, talking as you are, but who had the temperament at age 4 months that I called high reactive and was fearful at 1 year. And out of a clear blue sky, this girl or boy would say, you know, I don't like to be touched. You know, my school is going to Washington on a bus trip, and I'm a little scared because I've never been to Washington, even though they're external. What you see on the film looks perfectly relaxed. So these feelings are difficult to control, even though you can change your outward personality.
Let's take another couple of calls. A lot of people would like to ask you a question. Charlie, hi. Charlie's on the line from Longmeadow, Massachusetts. You're on the line with Jerome Kagan.
Yeah. Hello, Bob, Professor. I'd like to ask you a question. Can emotions be a form of intelligence? Before you get to that, I want to say that, you know, as far as intimidation, well, I feel it. I come from a working class. I'm not a working class person in the sense that I don't have a working class job, okay? I've lived a kind of a unique life, a disabled veteran. Ethnicity, Sicilian. So right away we have some high emotion, powerful emotion, and I see it as a form of intelligence, but oftentimes if you express it, people think that you're off the wall. You're losing it. You're angry. You're mad, you know. But this is the way I am, and I think it's a form of intelligence, and I'd like to hear what you have to say, Professor.
Go ahead, Professor.
Well, you know, as with emotion, we can use the word intelligence any way we want. Daniel Goleman has a book, as you know, called Emotional Intelligence. My own view is that, of course, you have adaptive emotions that are advantageous for you. But I think it would be more useful to restrict the word intelligence to the phenomena it was invented for, namely your scores on certain tests that people made up, and talk more about emotional sophistication, emotional adaptation, rather than corrupt the word intelligence. But it's your choice. If you want to call it intelligence, it's perfectly okay with me.
Charlie, thank you for your call. And now to Edwin, who's going to talk to Jerome Kagan. Edwin is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi there.
Yes, hi. I'm concerned about the emotion of guilt. I'm a psychotherapist, and I work with people and try to absolve them of their guilt. To do that, I try to have them believe that there's no such a thing as free will. And I treat their problems with addiction to the fact that they have addiction disease, and the fact that they have addiction disease is the reason why they've done all these very awful things that they've done as a result of their addiction disease. I'm wondering what you think about that approach, because I catch a lot of heat from my colleagues because they say, well, without personal responsibility, what's going to happen to society? People are going to be turned loose as if in a jungle.
Edwin, let's get the professor to respond to that.
Another very good question. Free will is a very complicated issue. My own view is that there is a sliver of freedom and that we are not total slaves of what our brains are doing, of the genes we possess, or our past experiences. That is to say, at this moment, I could, if I wanted, get up and stand on the table in front of Bob Oakes. And there's no measure of my brain that you could take that would tell you that I was going to do that. We do have. Because in the end, if you really understand what the physicists who do quantum mechanics are saying, there is in the end ultimately indeterminism, even in our brain processes. So we do have freedom. That doesn't mean that we're free to do everything, that our brains do constrain what we can do, and our experiences constrain. We are limited in what we can do, but we are not totally enslaved either by our past or by our biology.
Edwin, thank you for your call. I'm Bob Oakes, and this is On Point. Professor, let's come back to a question, a topic that we discussed briefly earlier in the program as we come close to ending the program, and that is religion. In the book, You write about how religion can affect our emotions. Talk about how people, for example, respond to trauma in Israel.
Right. Humans are very vulnerable to the emotion of uncertainty. And then we have different ways of resolving it. Some do it through work. Some do it through their emotional relationships with others. There are others for whom a religious belief, a belief in a spiritual force, helps them deal with their uncertainty. And it turns out that in, for example, during the threats to Israel, those who were deeply religious turned out to be less emotionally stressed than those who were not. And in Turkey, in Turkish prisons, those who were there because they were committed to a political cause and were tortured suffered less post-traumatic stress disorder than those who were in prison because they were criminals and were committed to no ideological cause. Being committed to an ethical value system can be very protective of the corrosive emotions of guilt, fear, anxiety, and shame.
Do you think an automatic defense mechanism inside our head, or is it learned?
Is it learned? Well, we acquire the value system, but the commitment then automatically acts as a protective device. Yes.
Let's try and squeeze in one more call for Jerome Kagan before we end the program. Don is on the line from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Don. Make your question quick if you can, please.
Hi, Bob. Do you find that people change a lot? Because I think my temperament now at 50 is nothing like it was as a child. Well, there's a few similarities, but not much, and it's gone through several changes as a youngster. I had a feeling of kind of the spaciousness of existence and the feeling of freedom, and that have a fairly fatalistic outlook now as an adult.
Professor, do people change over time?
Oh, sure. Here I am in my eighth decade, and as I reflect on my mood most days, these moods are dramatically different from the moods I had when I was 20 or 30 years of age, of course.
How do emotions change when we reach our golden years, for example?
I think for a variety of reasons, both historical and biological, there is less anxiety over immediate challenges, much less. I think that there is a closing in and a tendency to invest much more energy in a small number of emotional bonds to your spouse, to your very close friends. I think one tends not to trash the present. In other words, when people who are young and are ambitious, the present moment is irrelevant. It's tomorrow. And I think as you grow older, that reverses itself, and the present moment becomes the more important source of emotional satisfaction.
So does that mean that the golden years really are good years for people emotionally?
For many, they are. I know for myself, the last 7 or 8 years of my life have been absolutely rich.
And what's untapped in research, so to speak, on emotions?
I think now that the techniques in neuroscience and biology have gotten so good and the psychologists are recognizing some of the relevant questions, I think in the next 20 or 30 years, we will see some major advances and understandings, and some of the words we use now will become extinct.
Professor Jerome Kagan, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Harvard University, where he served as Director of the Mind-Brain Behavior Interfaculty Initiative. His new book is called What is Emotion? Professor, thank you very much for a very emotionally enjoyable and intellectually stimulating hour.
Thank you.
On Point host Tom Ashbrook is recuperating from successful bypass surgery earlier this week. His doctor says the procedure went well. He'll be back in the host chair January 2nd. We're all at On Point pleased at that. This is On Point.